Friday, July 10th, 2015. After a 4th of July holiday, we're back. Of course, politics never takes a holiday, so we have some catching up to do, and we want to take a look ahead at what promises to be a big week on the First in the Nation caucus campaign trail. Hi, I'm James Lynch of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. With me today are Brett Hayworth of the Sioux City Journal. Good morning, Brett.
Morning, James. Good morning, everyone.
Ed Tibbetts of the Quad City Times. Good morning, Ed.
Hi, James. Hi, everybody.
Aaron Murphy, Lee Newspaper State House Bureau Chief. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, James. Good to be here.
You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes and Stitcher. First up, you say veto, he says financial responsibility. Governor Terry Branstad set off 4th of July fireworks a bit early with his line item veto of nearly $57 million in one-time funding for Iowa K-12 schools, as well as higher education funding. The sixth-term Republican said he didn't like the use of one-time funding, and the legislature hadn't approved the second year of school funding. Later, he said he wasn't convinced local school districts wouldn't use the one-time funds for ongoing expenses. Aaron, you covered the marathon legislative session and Branstad's version of Throw It Back Thursday. Were the vetoes a surprise?
They were not a huge surprise to me, especially for the mental health institutions to keep them open. I think we all saw the writing on the wall there. The education funding was only a surprise in that there were so many people pushing for him to approve that, and he even had members of his own party saying, we think that was a good compromise, we'd like to see it signed. But it wasn't a surprise if you listened to him in any of his interviews leading up to the day he signed off on them. He gave every indication that, as you said, he didn't approve of using one-time funding streams for ongoing expenses. He really gave little to no indication that he supported that big one-time chunk of money for schools. So in that sense, it was not a surprise.
Based on his track record, I mean, you're right. That isn't a surprise. He's never supported one-time funding for ongoing expenses. That's a mantra of legislative Republicans, too. But wasn't he at the negotiation table, and weren't his people at the negotiating table, and didn't they send a message saying, you know, one-time money, you're going to get vetoed? And I mean, didn't the legislators know that this was going to get vetoed?
Well, and that's a good question, and frankly, it's one that we may never know fully the answer to unless someone unexpectedly decides to be forthcoming. Talking about those guys who were actually in those negotiations, his staff was in on all those key negotiations throughout the end of the session there, so they were aware of what was going on. They insist they gave no promises one way or the other, so it was, especially for Senate Democrats, it was something of a calculated gamble to put that money in there and hope that the governor would approve it, especially, as you said, knowing his history. It also, I suppose, is the only card they have left to play in that they were clearly in no way going to get the Republicans to budge on the base funding increase. So it was a gamble, but it was really their only option.
So what happens now, Aaron? Anything?
Well, the Democrats are calling for a special session. They want to bring everybody back to override the veto. That takes a two-thirds vote in each chamber just to call the special session, then another two-thirds vote in each chamber to override the veto to say as succinctly as possible it's not happening. There's no way they're going to get enough Republican cooperation to get the votes they need to two-thirds support for the special session or for an override.
Right. I mean, I think it's worth noting that when the last time the legislature came back into session back in 2006 to override Governor Vilsack's veto of an eminent domain bill, that was the first time in more than 40 years the legislature had done that. So it's not a regular thing with the legislature to bring itself back into special session to override a veto. But I'm wondering, Ed and Brett, how is this playing in your communities? I mean, I guess the delegation from Scott County is split between Republicans and Democrats. Same over in Woodbury County. You've got both Democrats and Republicans in that delegation. Ed, how's it playing over there?
Well, among the Democratic lawmakers, they're angry. Republican lawmakers say that they're disappointed and surprised. Educators, of course, are very angry. What strikes me out of all this is how difficult this is going to make negotiations in the next session. If the one-time money that was the key to the deal, the key to ending this very long session, is not on the table for next year, then what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is Brett. Here in Sioux City, of course, what it meant to Sioux City, the school district here in the city, is $1.6 million. Throughout Northwest Iowa, it was varying amounts of money, from $25,000 to $60,000 to $100,000 to each of these, depending on the size of the school district. So, the veto did mean major money that's lost, statewide and obviously to Northwest Iowa schools as well. And there was a little to do, as you guys know, with some educators letting State Senator David Johnson from Wacheden know that they didn't like his vote, and then Johnson got into an exchange email that became public yesterday with a Waterloo teacher, and Johnson told the teacher initially to stop whining was his phrase, and then eventually they got onto a little less confrontational nature of their emails. But when I spoke with Johnson yesterday, he says he doesn't think that a special session will come about.
Okay. Are there any political consequences as a result of this, either for Governor Branstad or, I guess, legislative Republicans? Ed, you alluded to it'll make negotiations tougher next year. There's also elections next year. Is this going to be a factor in those elections?
Well, I think that, I think the main impact is it will make negotiations on allowable growth all that more difficult next year. And if that's the case, there will be I would think that would be an election issue. For Governor Branstad, he's getting pummeled by some editorial boards, but that's happened before.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'd agree with Ed. I think it'll be a campaign issue. I think the question is whether it'll be a voting issue, whether school funding is something that'll motivate people at the polls, especially in these legislative races and in some battleground races. I don't know that we can be certain that that's something that's going to move votes, but it'll be interesting, and we'll definitely hear about it. There's no doubt that Democrats are keeping a scorecard, and we'll hear about school funding endlessly on the campaign trail next year.
I keep wondering if state revenues keep going up and exceeding the projections of the Revenue Estimating Council, Republicans could come in next year and say, hey, 4%, right from the get-go, we'll give you 4% allowable growth. And what are Democrats going to do then? Ask for 6 or 8 to play catch-up? If it won't be...
What? triple their estimate in an election year?
Yeah. they ride to the rescue of education. Hey, look what we're doing for education this year. Okay. well, we'll come back to that if it happens. But moving on, another challenger for Senator Grassley. State Senator Rob Hogue announced this week he is forming an exploratory committee considering a run against U.S. Senate six-term Republican Chuck Grassley, who Hogue called a living legend. Former state lawmakers Tom Feagin and Bob Krause also are seeking the Democratic nomination, the second time for both of them. Brett, why would anybody run against Senator for Life Grassley, who has never received less than 64% of the vote in his re-elections?
Well, he's as you say, Senator for Life. He's won 6 terms. Certainly it's daunting. Maybe it's a case where only those with a machoistic streak should apply, perhaps.
Okay. I'm guessing Hogue and probably Krause and Feagin, too, are all pretty much unknown in Western Iowa. Brett, will it matter which one of these 3 Democrats gets the nomination?
Well, yeah, and I would agree that they are relatively unknown here, and they'd be better known in eastern Iowa. When Feagin ran last time, it was on economic justice, but, you know, when he came to the primary, he got a paltry amount of votes. So, you know, these are not highly known people, but Hoag is, I guess it does matter to Democrats. It's important that they have someone other than a mere name, someone with some heft. And some Democrats are certainly glad that Hoag seems to be going that route, that he will become a candidate.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, you've seen
you need to have someone who can help other candidates statewide, and if you want to get into what Hoag brings to the race, you know, he's got a Cedar Rapids base, he's won 5 elections, he's served in legislature and can point to things that he's accomplished there. Flood mitigation, you know, things that happened in Cedar Rapids from the, what was it, 2011, 2010 floods. You know, he can all point to those things. So when you look at who Grassley's had to go up against, you know, this would be maybe a higher level candidate than maybe what he's had in some of the elections.
Looking back 6 years when Feagin and Kraus ran, and Kraus eventually dropped out of that race, as I recall, the third candidate or the other candidate in the Democratic primary was Roxanne Conlon, who was a candidate with you know, some heft, as you say. Aaron, you've seen Senator Hoag in the legislature. What do you think he brings to this race, and does he bring that sort of heft that a Roxanne Conlon would bring to the race?
I think he has the potential to. I think Brett touched on some good things there, especially at the Cedar Rapids base. So he's got a good head start in eastern Iowa, which is obviously important to Democrats. He's been active on climate issues. He's been very outspoken against the governor on a number of topics, including the closing of the mental health institutions that we alluded to earlier. So he's been a voice for the party, and he's been active on some issues that are in Democrats' wheelhouse. So I think they'll like him as a candidate. And this isn't to discredit the chances of Kraus or Feagin, but I think Hoag does bring in some pretty decent credentials to the race. Now, the thing we're avoiding is, at the end of the day, does it really matter? Can he beat Grassley? He's still a long shot. But I don't think he comes in as a candidate that would have to be taken seriously. I don't think there's anything doubt about that. And the best thing about it for him, that we should point out, is he was just reelected to a new 4-year term, so he doesn't have to give up his Senate seat to run this campaign.
Okay, and continuing my offbeat predictions, my thought on Rob Hoag's race here is that this is his first step in running for governor in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of elections,
and
Democratic primaries, it appears Democrats are trying to clear a path to the nomination for Monica Vernon, the Cedar Rapids City Councilwoman, who is trying to run for re-election more frequently than Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. She ran for first district nomination in 2014. She ran for lieutenant governor in 2014, and now she's running for the Democratic nomination back in the first district. Last month, Ravi Patel, her chief opposition, at least in fundraising, dropped out. This week, Attorney General Tom Miller, State Treasurer Mike Fitzgerald, and former House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy endorsed her. They said that they're not waiting for Democratic primary voters to choose a candidate, but they're not trying to tell anyone, former House Speaker Pat Murphy of Dubuque, to stay out of the race. Murphy, sources say, has considered getting back into running again this year, but no one knows for sure if he's still considering it, and he's not returning phone calls. In endorsing Vernon, Tom Miller said it's time for First District Democrats to coalesce around Vernon and get behind a candidate who can win and beat incumbent Rod Blum. And in the 2nd District, Ed, there are rumors that Senator Mark Shulgren, a conservative libertarian Republican from Ottumwa, is planning to challenge U.S. Dave Loebsack. Is there anything to that?
Well, I've not talked to Senator Shulgren myself, but I have heard from others that his name is being mentioned as a possibility. it'd be an interesting race, but it's a tough one. Not Grassley tough, but look, it's a presidential year when Democratic-leaning voters tend to turn out in greater numbers. And Dave Loebsack, for all of the scorn that Republicans throw at him, has survived two midterm Republican waves. So it'll be tough. But in a presidential year, I think Republicans are going to want to have strong candidates filling slots across the board. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see somebody like Senator Chalmers run.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And looking ahead, next weekend, the 2016 presidential hopefuls and the international media horde that covers them will descend on Iowa again for back-to-back Democratic and Republican cattle calls. For the first time in the 2016 cycle, all five Democratic presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton, Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and former Virginia Senator Jim Webb will appear at the same event, and that's the Iowa Democratic Party's Hall of Fame celebration in Cedar Rapids. Ed, what's at stake here, especially for front-running Clinton and for Bernie Sanders, who appears to be the only competition she has in this race?
Well, I think this poll that and other polls that have shown Bernie Sanders gaining is really the backdrop to this event. Previously, it's all been supposition about how much strength Sanders has. Big crowds are an indicator, but when you've got polls that show him gaining ground, that's tangible. You know, I think it's important to note he's still 20 points down, and one party function, one cattle call, doesn't make or break a candidate. But it can have an impact. I mean, look at Carly Fiorina. She's performed well at a couple of cattle calls on the Republican side, and while the polls still show her pretty far down the pack, she's getting talked about. Here's one thing I might say about that dinner that I think is important. I think this could be an important opportunity for Martin O'Malley. So far, Bernie Sanders is seen as the non-Clinton alternative. This is a chance for O'Malley to leave an impression on very active voters.
Interesting point there. Brett, let me turn to you and ask about the following day, Saturday, July 18th, the Family Leader, a conservative Christian group, will host nine GOP hopefuls at Iowa State University campus, where they'll be interviewed by Frank Lutz, a political consultant and pollster, who's known for developing talking points and messaging for various Republican candidates and causes over the years. Again, what's at stake here for these Republicans? They're appearing before a very conservative audience, but an audience that is very active in the caucuses. Is this a breakout opportunity for someone?
Right, that's right. You know, nailing down support with those who are likely to caucus is very important, and many of those conservative Iowans are socialist conservatives are looking for a candidate to support. So yeah, that's what's at stake. Especially in such a wide field, the conservatives need the conservative candidates need to figure out a way to stand out, to get ahead of the others. And I presume that the social conservatives that will be attending and watching at that event will be ripe to talk about the Supreme Court recent rulings from June, the rulings affirmed Obama's health care plan, the Obamacare federal health care plan, and made gay marriage legal nationally. So, you know, at the event, the Republican candidates will jockey to, you know, talking about what they want to do in response to those, in the aftermath of those decisions. And, for instance, Mike Huckabee wants Christian pastors to resist, gay marriages and not perform them. So, do you have time for one more factor that might not get aired there, but which would be a good point as far as people try to rise from the field is, of course, we know the candidates are filing these quarterly FEC reports in July, and we learned that Jeb Bush, who of course is seen as a moderate, but he and his PAC raised $115 million for the quarter, which is just mind-boggling. But at the same time, Ted Cruz and his PAC raised $51 million. That gives Cruz the ability to say to these conservative right, you know, look, I'm the only conservative who has the capacity, the money to win, so to speak. So, of course, the addendum is that sometimes conservatives don't flock to the money candidates, and we saw that in 2011 with the rise of Rick Santorum, who ultimately won the Iowa caucuses.
Good point there, because Cruz, if he can make that argument that he can raise money, he's also someone who really speaks to that conservative Christian audience in ways that...
Absolutely.
Yeah, Yeah, so that's a good point, and it'll be interesting to watch because those reports come out next week, don't they? July 15th, I think, is the deadline.
Yeah.
So we should have lots of numbers going into the weekend on who's up and who's down in the fundraising, the sort of the invisible primary. Well, that's it for this edition of On Iowa Politics. I hope it was worth your time. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, tell a friend and subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Fan mail may be sent to oniwapolitics@gmail.com. You can find us every week on the home pages of the Quad City Times, Sioux City Journal, Muscatine Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Waterloo Courier, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Craig Erickson, a Cedar Rapids blues singer, will take us out. If you know a band or a talented Iowa musician who should be on our show, send us a sound file. And remember to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. For Ed, Aaron, Brett, and our producer, Richard, I'm James Lynch. Thanks for listening.
Together start a new chapter.